Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show. And as always, got a great show planned for you. This is, after all, the most scintillating hour of finance radio. No laughs, no jokes. Anyway, we hope it is. Got some great content for you today and have a fascinating story that I'm pretty sure the majority of you haven't heard. We're going to be joined today by our special guest, Larry McDonald, who is the currently the purveyor of the Bear Traps Report, a Wall Street research firm. And Larry's had a really interesting career. He's also the author of A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, the number one New York Times bestseller about the failure of Lehman Brothers. And what I love about his story, his book, is that we've heard the story from the outsiders, right? The Big Short was probably the most prominent, well-known. But Larry was running the proprietary trading desk inside of Lehman Brothers when it failed. And interestingly enough, the trading desk had recognized the issue in real estate and subprime significantly before it became a problem, or before it metastasized out into the rest of the economy. And they were aggressively shorting those things in 2007. Their trading desk generated $2 billion worth of profit. And you know, people are, well, why'd they fail? Well, because they were losing so much on the back end of it. So it's just a fascinating tale, and I can't recommend the book strongly enough. Again, A Colossal Failure of Common Sense. And Larry's been kind enough to join us today, and his interview will be coming up. One little note, we had Larry for an hour and didn't want to waste a minute of it. We actually got him for an hour and 2 minutes. So we got him to go a little over. But that's going to result in a hard cutoff at the end of the show on the interview. If you want to hear the remainder of the interview, which I would suggest you do, because from a guy that spotted the issue inside of Lehman, lived through it, and then wrote the New York Times bestseller, one of the last things we ask him is, what should retail investors be doing? What should they be looking at? Should they stay in their indexed, their ETF portfolio, stay long the S&P 500? What approach should they take? And it didn't mean to put that at the tail end of the interview. It's just the way things progressed. But anyway, to hear that, to hear the end of this, because like I said, they're going to have that hard cutoff. You can go to Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. You can Google that. That will take you to the Stitcher website. You can find our podcast on iTunes. Just type in Know Your Risk Radio. We also do the podcast on MyNorthwest.com. It's all over the place. So if you just Google our podcast, you'll pull up a list of episodes and you'll just hit the most recent one. And it's the interview with Larry McDonald. So really excited to bring that to you. Great guy. Very fascinating for me to listen to him because he's one of the only guys that we've interviewed on the show and one of the only guys that I know of who's worked on all sides of the industry. I have, but not certainly not at the scale he has, but has worked on both the institutional side, so running an investment, you know, a trading desk and investment bank, and then also been a broker, a financial advisor selling retail products. And that just gives you a different view of things. It really does. And interestingly enough, I think it's baked into our financial approach. Our investing approach, trying to take that more esoteric, that more ethereal definition of risk management that we talk about so much on the institutional side of trading, on the institutional side of investing, and applying that to the retail side. And the reason that's important is because you have to understand, as a retail investor, you know, you listen to the Dave Ramseys of the world. And first of all, I've got nothing but respect for Dave Ramsey. I've said that many times. I think the guy is brilliant, and I think he's done a lot of great things. He's a great guy. But you've got what's best for the retail client, this normal retail portfolio. And what you will see is it is drastically underperformed over the last 10 years or over the last 20. And a great deal of that is because there's no risk management involved. More importantly, the risk management that is involved in retail portfolios is the bond portfolio. And there's so much misinformation regarding that. First of all, the first thing you're going to hear, and we will do the market update, but this is kind of part of it. But the first thing that you're going to hear, and we've spoken about this on the show countless times, is that stocks are our offense and bonds are our defense, meaning that when stocks go down, bonds go up and vice versa. Okay, well, that hasn't happened for 10 years, right? And there's a reason for that. And then more importantly, we went back and did the research over last 150 years, that positive correlation or that intertwined relationship between stocks and bonds has only existed about 30% of the time. So there are these giant misnomers, and this gets into our charlatan rant. And when you call someone a charlatan, it's seen as such a pejorative term, it's such a negative connotation, and that's really not the way we mean it. I don't think it's a good thing. But I think that there is a horrific lack of financial education in our society at large, but it extends into the financial advisory world because most of these guys have not studied finance. They haven't been on multiple sides of the desks. They have been taught how to sell financial products. And as a perfect illustration of that, we always, and if you've heard us before, you've heard us talk about our bond replacement strategy. You've heard Dory Monson talk about our bond replacement strategy. And you've heard us run these show segments called The Dirtiest Word in Investing, and it's annuity. And I'll say it again. I've said it a million times. I think most annuities are highly inappropriate, too laden down with fees, and will not deliver the type of returns that clients are expecting when they're sold. But it isn't because they're bad. It's because they're not understood by the people that sell them. And a perfect illustration of this was I was sitting down with a client this week who went and talked to their Morgan Stanley broker, and they were looking for a good, safe product that delivered a realistic return. The guy literally said between 5.5%, 6.5%, you know, we're not looking to, shoot the stars out, Zach. We're just trying to find a good, safe investment that will protect us and give us a decent chance to grow. And he goes, and I asked my Morgan Stanley broker, what about these fixed annuities? And first of all, I said, you mean these fixed income annuities? Well, there's no such thing as a fixed income annuity. That's just a traditional annuity. And he said, well, look, everybody thinks they're really safe, but the insurance companies can go down too. Again, look at AIG. And I started laughing. This is a perfect example of misinformation and charlatans. And what I mean by that is I'm sure he's a great guy. Okay. But he's horrifically outlining or blatantly outlining his ignorance. These products are backed up by the Washington State Guarantee Fund. These insurance products, just like life insurance is, if the insurance company goes under, they're protected. It's like the insurance version of FDIC insurance. And I'm not saying it's on par, but what I'm saying is there is a layer of protection, which is why none of these annuity products went belly up in the last recession. It's why they didn't go belly up during the Great Depression. They're insured. So it's just another classic example. And for those of you that aren't, look, you can say whatever you want. These other advisors can say this about these fixed index annuities. If you use the right ones, the ones that have no fees, the ones that have no performance caps, so there's no limit to the upside, right? And they've got shorter surrender schedules, so we're not looking at 15, 17-year contracts. If you use those types of products, you may not now, but I think that within the next 10 years, 80 to 85, maybe even as high as 90% of retail portfolios will have these products inside. Why? A, the security. They can't lose. You're insured against loss. Okay. B, they're going to generate returns that are far in excess of bonds in general, just because of where interest rates are. And C, if you use the right ones, they have no fees. So you're making the client much more safe. You're lowering their risk. You're lowering their fees, and you're increasing your upside. If we're fiduciaries, that's what we should be doing. And it was just a perfect illustration of the ignorance out there and the people talking out of school that don't know what they're talking about, but they're still pontificating to clients. And he literally looked at my client. He said, look, I think instead you should go for some safe stocks. Bing, ding, 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 alarm bell. Guys, there are no safe stocks over a long period of time. But in terms of volatility, that's why stocks give higher rates of return, is because of the risk. So anyway, just be careful with that. So as far as market goes, guys, we're still bumping up against these key levels. It looks to us like we could be approaching a breakout to all-time highs, so maybe not a bear market rally. But we're keeping an eye on the underlying economic indicators. They're still looking very weak around the world. Again, do not get sucked in to the over-bullishness out there. So anyway, we got to run. You guys know how to get a hold of us. If you want to look over your portfolio, do a review, 866-779-RISK. Go to the website, knowyourriskradio.com, bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. But we got to get to the interview with Larry. Great stuff, great content. Hope you enjoy it. Like I said, hard cutoff at the end, but you can Google our podcast. And I really hope you guys enjoy the show. We will talk to you next week. Enjoy the interview. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Many people with near or over $1 million in assets will mistakenly pay more in taxes in a long-term care situation than it would have cost them to set up an insurance plan to pay for the care needed. Due to recent changes in the Pension Protection Act, these new asset-based plans guarantee a tax-free benefit for long-term care and pay your estate back with interest if you never use it. But most importantly, it's about having a plan. All your children have to do is carry out your wishes, and you're not a burden on them. That's why I love the advice my wife and I got from Brian Ott and 525 Advisors. Brian has an asset-based class Saturday, April 13th in Bellevue. This class is aimed at individuals and couples who have accumulated close to or more than $1 million in assets and may be considering to self-fund long-term care costs in the future. Learn why that's not the best idea. Seat will be limited for this special asset-based class, April 13th in Bellevue. Reserve your spot, 525longtermcare.com. That's 525longtermcare.com.
Volatile markets are never fun, but it provides the opportunity to see exactly how much risk you're exposed to. Like Warren Buffett always says, when the tide goes out, you find out who's been swimming without their trunks on. Hey, it's Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. Chances are the defense portion of your portfolio, the bonds, got hit right along with your stocks. So what do you do? Look, safety doesn't have to mean lower returns. By using our bond replacement strategy, our clients have actually increased their returns while being insured against loss and all the while lowering their fees. Call now and get your free copy of our brand new booklet, Common Sense Investing, and learn how to protect your retirement against loss but still participate in market gains. Call 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Or go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Bulwark Capital Management is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys for joining us. And I'm excited to be joined by our guest today. I teased this on last week's show, and got a fascinating guest here, bit of a finance renaissance man, done a little bit of everything, and also the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Colossal Failure, A Common Sense, about the failure of Lehman, and told in first person, which is so much different than all these other memoirs that we've read about the collapse. And of course, I'm speaking about the great Lawrence McDonald. Larry, thank you. Do you prefer to be referred to as Larry or Lawrence? Is it Larry?
Yeah, Larry's fine. Thank you, Zach.
Okay, good. I didn't want to be talking out of school there. But anyway, Larry, thank you so much for joining us. And I've really been looking forward to this. First of all, loved your book. We're in 12 different languages. Do I have that right now?
We are in 12 different languages. I tell my, as a former Lehman trader, I tell my wife once a month, if we sell 1 million books, we'll break even on our Lehman stock.
The numbers are what, 600, 650,000 now copies of the book that have sold?
Yeah, we're about 650 now.
Yeah, I mean, that's no small dig. So it tells you, you know, it tells you what a hole was left on your personal balance sheet from Lehman. Before we get into that, because I am, like I said, I can't recommend the book enough. I thought you did a great, just a really interesting job of, you know, explaining it, but also your life story and how you integrated that into everything. I just, fascinating read. I couldn't recommend it enough. But I also wanted to start off with something that I identified with you right out of the gate, was your start. You were not a blue blood son of a hedge fund trader. Your dad was a very accomplished guy, but you weren't ushered into the best schools with the Ivy on the fences out front and a straight shot into the Ivy League. You went through, I think you used, in your words, you said you didn't go through the back door. You actually went through the back window. Give me a little bit. Start us off. You know, you were trying to break into the industry, get into the securities business, and you were nobody wanted to hire you. And you started off selling meat. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. Well, as Doyle Bronson, the famous poker player, always said, he said, when luck shuts the door, you have to come in through the window. And absolutely, my mom and dad got divorced when I was about 10. And for about 8 years, I was in 8 different schools. We went from the apple orchards of Bolton, Massachusetts, you know, beautiful, 10,000 square foot home to, a housing project pretty quick. And my brothers and I and my sister, big family, we had a number of tough years in Worcester, which is a really tough city. And but at the end, I think it made me a better person. You know, made me respect the value of a dollar and got me grounded. But when I eventually came out of school, we had the Gulf War was upon us, and we also had the SNL crisis. So those things were pretty fascinating. You have to remember there were hundreds and hundreds of savings and loans that went out of business in the United States and late 90s, early 90s. And so I tried to get a job. I think I had 100 rejection letters from all the different Wall Street banks, firms, and multiple times at each one. And finally, I made my way down to, I struck out in Boston, struck out in New York, and went down and tried Philadelphia. And I snuck into the building of this Merrill Lynch office, and I snuck in. I dressed up as a pizza delivery man. And I had my suit underneath, and I went into the bathroom. I was taking off the white overcoat, and I was caught by a couple of the producers, and they brought me into the office, and they sat me down on the chair, and they said, "What the heck are you doing?" And I just told them, I said, "Listen, I want to work with you guys, and I've got a burning desire to get into this business and achieve big things." And they said, "Well, you know, on the retail side of the business, Larry, the key to that is really sales and perseverance. So you have to go out and sell something." And then one of the guys on the desk just said, "Yeah, go out and sell pork chops." So it was kind of a dare, and I went out and for 3 or 4 months, sold pork chops, came back, and they gave me a job.
And then you became a, these are my words, of course, but a pork chop salesman extraordinaire. I mean, you were number one in the area. You went after that with the same abandon. You went after everything else, and you achieved a really pretty astounding level of success doing that, didn't you?
Yeah, it was just, New England back then was it's an interesting place to develop a business. And, I used a lot of those contacts to develop the retail business. So went from all the way from Philadelphia through New England back up Philadelphia all the way up to New England back. So it was an interesting time.
And so then you finally you parlayed that into getting into and I don't want to say it for you, but and for those of you that haven't read the book, we're doing a very high level overview here. So the actual stories themselves are. you know, I feel like I'm not even doing it justice. So I would encourage you, you know, to absolutely go read the book. But so then you finally break in. One of these sleuth pizza delivery deals works out for you. You finally turn some heads. You break in. You start selling convert bonds to the rich guys at the country club. And you started hitting your stride. And this was all about, correct me if I'm wrong, all around age 25, 26, correct?
Yeah, 25, 26. And I started to develop an attraction to the convertible bond market, because what was fascinating about convertible bonds is a convertible bond is part equity, right? So it's right. Part stock and it's part fixed income. So I figured, okay, I can learn two crafts at the same time. And it's also has an equity option component. So you can learn a little bit about pricing volatility. So I found that pretty fascinating. And in the mid-90s, my good friend and I, Steve Seafeld, started a website called convertbond.com. So I left the retail side of the business. I thought the retail brokerage business would be consumed, and I thought it was in a tough spot up against the Schwabs and the potential of online trading coming down the pike with the internet upon us. So we decided to create a website that focused on convertible bonds. And I look back and, we probably should have just created a dating website, you know? But we had a good time with convertbond.com, and we ended up selling it to Morgan Stanley in October of 99. 3 months before the top. So that was a very, very fortunate sale.
Boy, I would say so. The other thing, and this is kind of taking a side path here. The other thing I found interesting about these stories was, now this might be a loose connection to some, but I was fascinated at how you guys spotted the capability or the potential of the internet and integrating it into the business. Like you said, you saw the trouble that was going to or the shakeup, if you will, that was going to create in the industry. And then when I read the story about how you guys put Convert Bond together, reading the story from you, it just seems so obvious. And yet, like so many other things, and I don't want to give it away, but we would see this play out again during the Lehman crisis. Like so many other things, these changes or these turning points in economies and markets, they seem to not get noticed by the insiders, that it's those people like yourself that didn't follow the traditional path that tend to see these turning points, like the effect the internet would have in the securities business, like all the issues you saw going on in the real estate business. Why is it, Larry, from your perspective, from a guy that I think that your background is so unique, there's just not many guys that have hustled on the retail brokerage side of things and then been the head traders of trading desks inside Wall Street. Why is it that the outsiders seem to be the ones that pick up on these massive titanic turning points in economies? And while the people inside of it that came up the traditional route tend to be, I don't know if it's oblivious or I don't know if it's uncaring or reckless. Maybe it's a combination of all that. How do you describe that? Like I said, you got these two turning points where you guys saw the economic opportunity. Then you also spotted the real estate part of it, both of which the market, interestingly enough, right, the powers that be and the big players in the market, they miss both of them. Why are the outsiders typically the ones that spot these things?
Well, the biggest reason of all is they're not bought into, the buy-in when you're vertically integrated. Like Lehman was vertically integrated into mortgages. So what that means is when a company is vertically integrated, they not only originate the mortgages and sell them and move them on, but they own the mortgage company that originates them. And so they have multiple risks. And when you originate the mortgage and you own the mortgage company, and then you have a Wall Street bank that sells the mortgages to other people around the world, it's very easy to get so bought in that you ignore the risks. You know, that's because the business became, such a big part of the profits. And I always say, I always look back to what Steve Jobs, maybe 15 years ago, was at a conference in the West Coast in the Valley, and he was quoting Einstein, and he said, to the audience. He said, you know, talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see. And it's not really about genius. It's more about really working hard at looking for that risk. And whereas if you really work at it day in, day out, and you're not overly bought in and with the blinders on, right? So the buy-in yep. creates blinders. That combination allows you to find some genius.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the name of the show is Know Your Risk Radio. We're constantly preaching that message that, look, the positive outcomes will take care of themselves. What, you know, you can't be doomsdayers and lock yourself up in a bunker, of course. But, you know, our job as allocators of capital is really to focus on the risk and see the opportunity, but really, you know, really identify that hidden risk. And I just thought that was fascinating that here in your story, we had this perfect setup of where that viewpoint allowed you to see opportunity and where it also allowed you to see risk. And both things, you know, sandwiched in together in a decade, just 10 years, were greatly overlooked by the industry at large. And I found that fascinating. So anyway, moving it along. Go ahead.
Just want to say my favorite quote ever, and it's such a moving quote for me. And it comes back to J.P. Morgan in 1907. J.P. Morgan 1907 states, "There's nothing in this world which will so violently distort a man's judgment more than the sight of his neighbor getting rich." You know, the neighbor getting rich. And, you know, that says it all, because it's when you're in a cycle that is booming, it's very easy for the plumber or the electrician, you know, sees the brother-in-law making a fortune in real estate, flipping homes, and all of a sudden you had people all around the country leaving, you know, 10, 20, 30-year careers to go jump into, you know, the real estate game. And that's literally the sight of the neighbor getting rich distorting a man's judgment.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. That was one of the ways we identified it. When you look around and you see everybody making money the same way and talking about how great it is, you kind of that alone should cause some pause, right? We should take a step back at that moment and just say, wait a second, is it this easy? Because it probably shouldn't be. So, okay, so anyway, so moving on. And by the way, for those of you that have just joined us, we're with Larry McDonald, author of A Colossal Failure, A Common Sense, number one New York Times bestseller, and proprietor of the Bear Traps Report, who we are actually becoming a client of. He put out some amazing research. And so for those of you, they can find you at Lawrence, isn't it at Lawrence McDonald on Twitter? Did I get that right?
Well, it's at Convert Bond.
Okay, at Convert Bond.
At Convert
Bond. Yes,
yeah.
At Convert.
But you can find it with the name, too. The name works.
Okay. And a great follow. Okay, so now we're moving forward. We've got the start. Hey, you guys have got Convert Bond going. How did you – because I also really identified with your story of saying, hey, I'm going to do whatever I can to get here. But being a million-dollar producer in the retail channel was not the ultimate aspiration. It was to play in the big show. It was be down on the trading floors at the big exchanges. So how do we make that jump from a young guy, 26 years old, who's killing it on the retail side of it, starts Convert Bond, and then how did you break in? Where was that moment where you broke into the big game?
Well, my good friend from my hometown, I had a number of friends on Wall Street. So the first thing I did was I was at Morgan Stanley. I was running their convertible research effort or desk that called convertbond.com. So we were already on the institutional side. We were covering institutional accounts, but I wanted to work into trading. And I looked around through my entire Rolodex of friends all around the world that were in finance. And I had one friend that was at Lehman named Larry McCarthy. Larry McCarthy, Larry McDonald.
It works.
two Irish friends from the hometown. And I pitched him on, coming over there and starting a convertible trading business, convertible bonds, where we would work with their equity and fixed income divisions. And I met it did four or five interviews and got the job.
Okay. So now, and now you're a trader. Now you've made it to the big game. You're trading at Lehman. And again, guys, we're just giving you the cliff notes. You gotta read the book for yourself. But let's jump forward to when we start seeing some things. What is the first thing, as your career progressed? What was the first thing? And I don't know if you recall that very first moment, but where you looked around and said, "Hey guys, we might have an issue here as far as the real estate mortgage subprime issue." Where was that first realization, and how did you come to that?
Well, I'll never forget. We're on the trading floor in 2007, and Larry used to have a famous line about leverage companies. You know, think about a leverage company. They have lots of debt and very little equity. And Larry kind of yelled across the desk, "You know, that's big hat, no cattle." and then we started looking at the Lehman balance sheet, and Lehman was 44 times leveraged, 44 times. So that's like walking into a casino with $100 in your pocket, but you're playing at the table with $4,400. And
good while you're winning.
And so we were looking at this. I'm like, because when I joined the firm, Lehman was only like 25 times leveraged. Then 3 years later, we're like 44 times leveraged. And then one of the analysts that we had, Pete Hammack, brilliant analyst, did the math, and he told us AIG and Fannie Mae are 60 times leveraged. Jeez. And we had a discussion one day on the floor, like, what's really going on? And it was essentially, you know, the banks had these huge deposits, you know, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. So when an investment bank has to compete with a large institution, leverage is important, number one, because you're competing against all those deposits. And then the other thing that we started to realize is that the death of the partnership was extremely important to the crisis, where years ago, you know, through the last 100 years, a lot of these banks, insurance companies always had partners that owned all the equity. But when a company goes public and all the partners can sell their shares to the public, that's really the death of the partnership. So if Lehman had, or, you know, say any firm has a number of key partners that own all the equity, they're going to keep a much closer eye on the risk. Whereas when the equity of a firm is diversified across thousands of investors, and then you bring in rating agencies and the like, it's very easy for people to take their eyes off the risk.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly obviously with hindsight, that's exactly what was going on. And then you wrote about this too. I found it fascinating because I feel like it's, you know, guys like you and I talk about it. I feel like it's largely an esoteric topic to most of the people, most of the public. But I was fascinated by your work with Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall was kind of a hobby or a just an interest of mine in general, because I wrote a term paper at the end of my college career about WorldCom for my one of my final papers for my finance degree. And I went into that whole research process, and I promise this is gonna marry up. I went into the whole research process, digging into the WorldCom side of things, seeing where the fraud took place, and I kept ending inadvertently back to Glass-Steagall. And this was, you know, this is 2002, so significantly before the real estate collapse. And the term paper took a strange turn where it ended up being a focus on Glass-Steagall and how I didn't think the WorldCom thing, at least at the scale it grew to, was possible outside of Glass-Steagall. And then watching that come to the fore again in the 08-09 financial crisis, and then watching nothing happen to it on a legislative basis afterwards, it wasn't corrected. From your perspective, how much did the dissolution of Glass-Steagall play into all of this?
Oh, it had a ton to do, because when it wasn't just Bill Clinton, but it was Bill Clinton and the Republican.
Right.
They dismantled Glass-Steagall with the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. And it's... it allowed the investment banks to compete, you know, with the big banks. So you've got a bank like Lehman that's really small, no deposits, and all of a sudden you're competing against a bank with $2 trillion in deposits, right? So that just forces the investment bank to take lots of risks. And there was really, it wasn't an even playing field. And that, if I'm very confident that if Glass-Steagall wasn't dismantled, that the financial crisis would not have been anywhere near as severe as it was.
Well, and doesn't that play right in, and feel free to shut me down, but the way I've looked at it is, we were speaking earlier about the vertical integration. Had those things been separate, they would have been looked at with a much more jaundiced eye, right? They wouldn't have, at least from my perspective, you would have had, you know, just in the packaging of one of these mortgage bonds, you would have had two or three different risk offices assessing this as opposed to one, right? You wouldn't have had this inbred nature to it. And then one of the things that I posited or I came to was just that alone, kind of the dissolution of those firewalls that were previously in place just due to the fact that you couldn't be vertically integrated to that level. Don't you think that did that play into it as well? I mean, just kind of moving one hand, you know, moving money from one pocket to the other, meaning that, you know, this stuff didn't have to go through multiple compliance offices. It was just one. And these companies were allowed to, through Glass-Steagall, to become vertically integrated, in your words?
Yeah, and it was the regulators, because of the Glass-Steagall and because of the vertical integration, you went from one regulator that was looking at, say, the banks or the SNLs, so all of a sudden there were five regulators that were responsible for Lehman. So what happens when you have five regulators, responsibility goes out the window. So you had the New York Fed, you had the FDIC, the SEC, FINRA. So you had so many different regulators. And when you have that many, it's very clear that nobody is really accountable and nobody really takes authority.
Yeah, yeah. So, okay, so we've got this situation where you guys start seeing, you start seeing this all hat, no cattle scenario playing out. And the other part that I found fascinating was the visit that you guys made and the conversations you had with the folks at New Century. Was that, I mean, in the book that served as kind of a way marker, was that the point where you guys said, okay, this thing's going down. We need to play it from the short side. This is definitely the way that this thing's going to unfold. Was that the eureka moment, if you will, or did it come earlier?
Well, we with our research team, we look for what we call, you know, systemic risk indicators. We had a basket of risk indicators that were starting to rise. And the one thing that we started watching were early payment defaults. So let's just say early payment default is when someone misses their first mortgage payment. And we're not talking about a default on a mortgage. We're talking about buying a home and then counting around the country how many people are missing the first mortgage payment, the first one. And what we calculated in like 2006, in the whole country, there were less than 20 of them. But by 2007, that number had gone up to close to 2,000. In each quarter, that number was going up exponentially. So it was about creating a basket of indicators that would give you kind of an early warning sign. That really helped us a lot. And that's what we're doing today.
Okay. So yeah, same process then. And then you guys, the other thing that there was a lot fascinating, but the other thing that I found interesting is you guys tried to take this to supervisors. You guys started taking that eye of what you saw, that basket of indicators, and you started looking at Lehman's scenario and going, wait a second, we're not observing this from the outside. We're actually a part of it. And you started trying to make the supervisors, the guys that, you know, the risk managers aware of that. What was that process like? And was that insanely frustrating for you guys that those warnings weren't heeded?
Well, yeah. So Madeline Antonczyk, our risk manager, who we were educating Madeline on Tonsic on a regular basis and just showing her some of our data. And she was very helpful. So she took some of our data into the meetings, and then she was actually thrown out of a meeting by our CEO. And so it got to the point where what happens on Wall Street when the executives – When the CEO has, you know, tons of control over a board, the risk management people just become, you know, it's just unbelievable. They become almost like bureaucrats that are just not respected, and that's what was happening with Lehman.
Well, and you had a somewhat of a tyrant at the top there with Dick Fuld, and I just from your stories about it, and then anecdotal stories from my time in the industry, it's. He wasn't the most open-minded fella when it came to identifying these risks and taking heed. And I just one of the interesting things that I'd never really thought about reading your book was Lehman really didn't get caught unaware. There were plenty of people inside the company that saw the issue. He just didn't want to listen to it. Like you said, it just everybody became, you know, I guess subjects of Dick Fuld and where he wanted to take things, and that was just sort of the end of the story. Was when did you guys know that about him at that time? Because I just not to beat around the bush, I was surprised through going through the read at how much of this you laid at his feet and the executives running the company. I was expecting to read more of a systemic failure type thing where it really was from your perspective, you know, much more of a focused screw up, if you will, or a blind spot. Were you one and only in the firm? I mean, was there a very select few of you that had that impression, or were many of you concerned about the blindness or the willful blindness of Dick Fuld and some of the upper management around him?
Well, the words I always live by is, there's no I in team ever.
Right.
And I was part of a wonderful group of people. So there was Mike Gelban now was the number two man at Millennium. He just founded a $8 billion hedge fund, Exodus Point. Mike was a very, very brilliant risk manager and clearly saw the warnings. And Mike helped us. We, as a group, you know, there's no I in team, but in 2007, we made close to $2 billion on the short side, betting against some of these, like you said, the New Centuries and some of these companies in the mortgage space. And but for every dollar we were making, they were losing about eight upstairs.
Wow. Wow. And that again, was another part of the story that really shocked me, because I sat there and I went, it's just unbelievable that you've got a trade desk that so clearly identified the issue that they were making billions of dollars in profit on it while they were literally profiting off the poison that was slowly killing the firm, slowly at first and quick picked up the pace. So, okay, now from the inside going, from the inside out, because again, my experience and everybody else is watching this unfold from the outside. When was that moment in time where you guys at the Lehman trading desk went, oh no, it has started and this is headed in the wrong direction? I know you guys saw the seeds of it. We've already talked about, but where was that moment where you said, okay, the game is on. This thing is happening now.
When New Century in February 2007, and New Century equity went from $32 to zero in like 30 days.
Yep.
And remember, New Century was a mortgage originator. And so we had gone out about the month before that. We were short New Century. We'd gone out to the West Coast. And the big short movie kind of stole our scene. But there's a scene in the book where we go out to the West Coast, and we went to this kind of lounge bar near New Century where their offices were. And we saw this the Corvettes, the Lamborghini, some Porsches outside. And we go in there and we start talking to some of the salespeople on a Friday. It might have been a Thursday, Friday, you know, around 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. Everybody's getting out of work. And, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing from some of these people. They were selling these, you know, they weren't the brightest bulbs on the planet. They were making millions of dollars a year. and they were selling, adjustable rate reset mortgages to people that, you know, kind of loans that would actually, they knew would blow up on their clients, you know. So these are really bad people, and these products are massively unsustainable. And this was New Century's, you know, kind of sales force. And then we came back to New York, and sure enough, a month later, we put on a bunch of shorts and put spreads on New Century, and a month later, the company imploded. And that was really the moment we knew that this is a real problem.
One of the things that cracked me up is you guys were structuring those put options and those shorts, and you were sitting there saying, hey, if this thing drops to 20, we're going to make a pile. Little did you guys know that you weren't going to have to. 20 was not going to be the threshold of profit for that trade. That thing was going to zero in a hurry. I got a chuckle out of that because, you know, from the inside out, we're risk managers. You're setting up a trade and you're sitting there going, okay, where is the point where this thing's going to be profitable? When you guys were putting that on, again, the structuring of the trade, I know you don't think like that. Did you think it was a zero? Or did you just think it was going to get hammered hard? What was the viewpoint of that? Were you guys thinking, okay, this thing is going to nothing, or is it just it's going to get hammered hard?
Well, our analyst, Christine Daly, who's like one of the best distress analysts, she was looking at – the company wasn't quite distressed yet, but she was looking at the assets. She was looking at the balance sheet. She thought it was a zero, but – you know, we all thought it would take a good year. What we didn't imagine is that it would take that short period of time. And what people have to understand, and for investors listening to us right now, the one thing to always remember is when you look at a stock or, you know, any stock, you have to look at the whole capital structure. So there's debt and equity. And with some companies, say like Apple, Apple's equity is 90% equity. I'm sorry, Apple's enterprise value. So the value of the whole company for Apple is 90% equity and like 10% debt.
Right.
But most people just look at the equity, right? And so there are companies out there like Tesla that are, you know, that are, or Deutsche Bank or some of these leveraged banks where right. you can have a company that's 50, 60, 70% debt and maybe 30, 40, 50% equity. And in the case of New Century, the public equity might have been $30 a share, but the company had tons and tons of debt and off-balance sheet leverage. So Christine just felt if there was a problem, the equity would get wiped out really fast because, let's just say in this case, the equity might be $30, maybe that's $2 billion, but they had close to $20 billion of debt and obligations. So net, you really, even though the stock's $30, you think you own a stock, but you just own a little tiny sliver of equity in a pie. And when you have that type of just a sliver of equity in a pie, that's where the stock can go to zero really, really fast.
Yeah, you've got that upside down equity or that upside down capital structure. And that's funny because I listened to that today. I think you can be too far inside sometimes and the old adage, if you're standing 4 inches away from an elephant, try to describe it. You got to step back to get some view and some scale. But you don't hear people talk about enterprise valuation enough anymore, right? Taking that debt into consideration and looking at that capital structure. And it kind of surprises me because I feel like we're here again, only another 9 or 10 years later. I hear that same mistake being made. And I don't want to make this transition too quick because I want to ask you a couple things. And we got to take a quick break. So I'll ask you that question when we get back. But we got to take a quick break. So stick with us. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with my financial advisor, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital and host of Know Your Risk Radio. And Zach, what I love about you guys is your focus on risk management.
Well, Dory, we're a fiduciary and a holistic retirement planning firm. Our goals are simple. Get our clients the highest returns with the least amount of risk and cost.
I know they're normally used for safety, but how risky are bonds right now?
If a significant portion of your retirement portfolio is in cash or bonds, that just doesn't work in this low interest rate environment on the verge of inflation. You need a bond replacement strategy.
I gotta tell you, you have to read it. Zach's brand new version of Common Sense Investing. You'll learn that bond replacement strategy, learn how to protect your retirement against loss, but still participate in market gains. Call now, get your free copy, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK, or go to knowyourriskradio.com. Bulwark Capital Management's a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back, and we are joined today with Larry McDonald, author of A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, the inside story about the collapse of Lehman. He was running their trade desk at the time and doing quite well, as ironically they were short mortgages and made a killing, just not enough to fill up that capital hole. As Larry says, they were bringing, for every $2 they brought in, $8 was going out the back door. Larry is also the purveyor of the Bear Traps Report, which is an economic research firm, and you can get them at ConvertBond, at ConvertBond on Twitter. And so let's get right back to it. So to the question I was teasing before the break, do you see similarities with where we are currently at in relation to where we were at in 08-09?
Yes, but not from the banks, more from the corporations. So
right.
What's happening now is, you know, elections have a lot to do with business cycles. And what we're going to see the next couple of years is the White House is going to do whatever they possibly can to extend this business cycle. You know, they're getting help from the Fed. The Fed promised us 3 rate hikes this year in October. And then by, you know, early January, the market's starting to look at 2 rate cuts in terms of probability. So that's a reversal of 5. You know what I mean? We were going to go from 3 rate hikes to now, as of this, you know, say as of the first quarter, the market's looking for 2 cuts. So that's a huge, colossal move in central bank policy. And that plus some fiscal stimulus, if the White House has a number of plans that I think they're in the works from whether Fannie and Freddie to expand the credit box there. So what happens is that you have a business cycle that's gone on for a long time. You have an election, and they will do whatever they can to extend this cycle. And what will happen is the debt profile of on the corporate bond side is already right now really, really, really ugly in terms of leverage. And it's only going to get more leverage the next, you know, 6-9 months. And then we're going to have a big collapse sometime in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. But they're going to do whatever they can to keep it right after the election.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to talk to you. So, you know what? I won't try to hold this back because this is really what I've been interested in. Well, I think the whole thing is interesting. But the point I wanted to get to was to ask you where we're at now. So how... And I know we're all stabbing in the dark here, but the ability for central banks to keep juicing this thing and keep things on the rails has really astounded me. I really thought that they would lose control at some point. How much longer do you think that they can extend this process? And what do you think will be the break point? You know, and again, I understand we're all speculating at this point, but where is that point where the transmission of all this central bank policy breaks down and the weight on the other side of the scale becomes too great for the Fed to keep propping things up?
Well, it's going to be similar to remember the early payment default with the mortgages, right?
Yep.
So they lent so much money to so many poor borrowers that they, in other words, the lending was so disgusting and so prevalent, the excessive lending, that they were lending to people that couldn't make the first mortgage payment, right?
Right.
So the same thing now is happening with countries, okay, so sovereign countries, you know, as well as corporations. So what we're going to start to see sometime in the next, you know, 12 months most likely, is a point where corporations start missing their first coupon payment on a bond. So you'll have a multi-billion dollar issue bond. Everybody wants to buy it because the Fed's on hold and, you know, the White House is doing whatever they can to juice the economy. And you want to watch, instead of that early payment default on mortgages, you want to watch corporate bonds and sovereign bonds missing those early coupon payments.
Yeah, so that's that ignition point that you guys are looking for. And I echo that. I think of Tesla. You brought Tesla up, and we just had a bond repayment, and I don't think that they're going to be able to raise capital through selling equity. So my guess is they're going to try to access the bond markets again. And I'm no credit expert, but you know that you think about Tesla, and I think about a scenario where you could easily see a company like that take out a big bond payment, or you know, do a big money raise, a debt raise, and miss that first interest payment. That'll be fascinating to keep an eye on. So between now and then, over the progression of this, what do you think the road to that is? And do you think there's any way? How do you think that they're going to try to combat that? Because the one thing that I've come to the realization of, probably too late, only a couple years ago, was, look, they're not going to get religion all of a sudden and turn around and start acting like responsible actors. I don't see that happening. They're just going to keep trying to kick this can down the road. So where is that path, and what do you think, if any? I mean, is there a policy response to when this scenario starts playing out? What is the role?
Well, the first thing is this year we have $750 billion of corporate debt. So investment grade loans and high yield, $750 billion coming due. And over in Italy, for example, Italy has $850 billion coming due in the next 3 years. So we have a lot of really, you know, poor quality companies, a lot of near-term debt maturities in not just on the corporate side. In total corporate debt in the United States is three times what it was just over a decade ago.
Wow.
And we have a major maturity wall coming at us. So it won't take much. I mean, the central banks are going to have to be shift being very accommodative to prevent a major default push. But once again, an accommodative means cutting rates. But the problem is, it gets back to that whole early payment default thing. If the Fed goes really dovish one more time and starts to cut rates and allows for more easy borrowing, you're just going to get to a point where they've lent the money to the worst quality companies. At some point, you just reach, when we're very close, you just reach a point where defaults just happen because the cash flow of the companies just can't support the debt profile.
Yeah, well, and again, I don't mean to pick on Tesla. I may have heard this from you, but Tesla, and I looked into it and I verified it, but so if you didn't say it, I know that it's true. But I think Tesla is the first company that's ever passed something like a $35 billion market cap and had debt trading in junk levels. Was that your quote? Did I pick that up from you?
Yes. It was 52 billion of equity market cap with a junk bond. I mean, it's just crazy. Like, think about it. Just think, sit back and think. That doesn't make any sense, because junk bonds, like in my entire career going over 35 years, a junk bond is issued to a company that doesn't have that much equity. Because if you have lots of equity, you shouldn't have to issue bonds at, say, close to 7-8%.
Right.
And when treasuries are yield, treasuries are yield.
All right, as we warned you in the opening segment in the market update, we got to cut this short due to time constraints. But you can go to our podcast page. Just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. You can go to iTunes, stick in Know Your Risk Radio, MyNorthwest.com. It's all over the place. But I do think that it's worth listening to the end of this. We've got Larry discussing to us what he is advising clients do, what retail investors should be looking at. We get into the dollar bull, dollar bear debate, which I think is really a linchpin about everything. We talk about passive versus active investment and management. We also talk about, noticing that the U.S. market is the most expensive out there right now, and opportunities outside the U.S., and what retail investors, like those listening to this show, what you should be guarded against and what are potential pitfalls. So anyway, good, great stuff remaining in the show, and I'd encourage you to go get that podcast. And then you can also subscribe to it, and it'll just, when we come out with a new episode or a new segment, it'll just get emailed to you. So anyway, thanks again for listening. We got to run. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.